This message, titled The Call to Civility, is the third of three given at a conference titled The Call that featured Oz Guinness and Stuart McAllister and took place at Perimeter Church in Duluth, Georgia, May 2nd and 3rd, 2008. The Call was co-sponsored by the church and the C.S. Lewis Institute.
Accent wars we've had. We're in a Presbyterian church, of course, so the Scottish accent is the royal accent. I mean, every good Presbyterian pastor has to speak with a Scottish accent. Go to St. Andrews or Edinburgh or something like that. Now, if we're in an Anglican church, mine might do better. But we're not. I was once speaking with Tony Campolo, and you know what sort of accent he has coming from Philadelphia. And he started by saying this. He said, listen, this guy Guinness speaks for 20 minutes before you realize he's not saying anything. He said, with my inner city Philadelphia accent, I have to speak for 20 minutes before you realize I am saying something. Now, in fact, my accent's not terribly English. I have been to school and university in England, but my family are Irish. I was born in China, and I've lived all over the world except England. But I call my accent mid-Atlantic. It's sort of, in England, I'm taken as American, and in America, I'm taken as English. But it's a real pleasure to be with you. Let's turn to a far tougher subject than I was on last night, but one that we equally have to wrestle with, like the great one that Stuart raised in the first session today. Let's take the question that's thoroughly controversial and prickly today, religion and public life. And I will argue that many of our Christian brothers and sisters are part of the problem, not part of the answer. It would be a safe but very sad bet that someone, somewhere, right now, is being killed in the name of religion. We've been sickened by the years of watching the Sunni-Shia violence. But if we went to Kashmir, it would be Muslims and Hindus. Or we could drop down to Sri Lanka and it'd be Hindus and Buddhists. Not long ago, we could go over to Northern Ireland, be Catholics and Protestants, and so it goes. The last century ended with an arc of blood and violence that was a humanitarian nightmare, a witch's brew of ancient hatred spilling over all around the world. Now, immediately, our atheist friends would say, there you go, religion. Divisive, violent, evil, as Christopher Hitchens says, how religion poisons everything. But of course, they don't take on board the fact that, yes, religion, but also ideology. So more people died in the 20th century in regimes led by secularist intellectuals in the name of secularist ideologies than all the Western repressions and persecutions combined. It is tragically true that 100 million died in war, and another 100 million under political repression, and yet another 100 million through sectarian and ethnic violence. Now, as people look back over the 20th century, there are a number of very simple conclusions that we have to wrestle with as human beings who care for our world. The first is simple. The problem of how we live with our deep differences is a world human problem. How do we live with our deep differences? That sounds very abstract compared, say, with nuclear proliferation or global warming or HIV/AIDS or whatever it is. But more people will die because of that than the other three. It is one of the world's great global questions. We're living in a world that said everyone is now everywhere. Here comes everyone, as one of the recent books puts it. In other words, you have entire religions and ideologies that are not just private preferences, but entire ways of seeing the world and entire ways of living, elbow to elbow with other entire ways of seeing the world and entire ways of living, all in the same society. And never has that exploding diversity been on the scale it is now because of our modern travel, because of our modern media, and above all, because of our mass movements of people, which we see in the West through challenges of immigration. The problem of living with our deep differences is one of the world's great issues. Second thing you can see is this is exacerbated in the age of the internet galaxy by the emergence, for the first time in human history, of a global public square. Now, we're Westerners. The public square is an old idea to us that goes back to the Greeks. And if you look at the Greek idea of the agora, or the Roman forum, there was a literal place, a square, where citizens came together to deliberate and to debate and then decide the issues of their common life. And that was the public square. And as you know, the Greeks, as they put it, did not want what they called tribespeople, people who only thought in groups. They did not want what they called idiots. And they didn't mean people a little mentally daft, but they meant people who only thought in terms of their private interests. They wanted citizens, people who were individuals, but could think and debate and discuss in terms of the common good, the common vision for the common good. And they did it in the public square. Now, as this developed in our Western history, take, say, the rise of modern democracy, it was a metaphor, not a place. It wasn't Westminster Square, Lafayette. The radio, the television, all sorts of places where citizens debated the issues of common life. But now, of course, in the age of the internet, you can see the beginning not speaking to the world today, we can be heard by the world today. I first noticed this when Jerry Falwell, the late Jerry Falwell, made some rude remarks about Muhammad in Lynchburg. Now, Lynchburg is not exactly the capital of the universe, let alone the United States. But rude remarks in Lynchburg, riots in Lahore. He wasn't speaking to Pakistan, but he was picked up in Pakistan, and the responses were there. Since then, of course, we've seen the Danish cartoons or the response to the Pope's speech at Regensburg. But you can see the simple lesson. Even when we're not speaking to the world, we can be heard by the world. I could make some very rude remark today about who knows what and who knows what response there could be tomorrow. I'm not going to do it. But you can see that is the age of the internet, and things can be picked up like that, and nothing today is private. Barack Obama discovered after his remarks in San Francisco, and so on. We can be heard by people that we're not intentionally speaking to. Now the question is, how do we live together in the global public square? There are no rules for that. And we've got to figure that out in the next 50 years. But there's a third little lesson that people saw as they look back from the vantage point of the end of the 20th century, and that was America, who Madison said had the most nearly perfect solution, what he called the true remedy for religion and public life. The United States, which has prided itself on being the Novus Ordo Seclorum, the new order of the ages, the city on the hill, and all these things, today is not doing very well either. Now you can see the irony of that. America has been described as the world's first new nation, in the sense that the United States, 200 years ago, wrestled with many of the issues that are at the very heart of our modern world. So it's the first modern new nation. And there are issues that wrestle with other countries didn't. So the framers talked of it as the new order of the ages and so on, with the idea it would be an example to the world, the city on the hill, which Winthrop and more recently Reagan referred to. But of course, in those early days, the rest of the world wasn't interested. They were not wrestling with what we call today the modern problems. But they are today. When I grew up and went to school in England, it was incredibly homogeneous on the whole. There was some diversity, but in school I went to, the only person who was not an Anglo was actually the son of a very wealthy Indian business leader. You look at London today, exploding with diversity, with all the Commonwealth immigration, etc., 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 far more so than most American cities. But here's the irony. When America trumpeted it, City on the Hill and all that, the world wasn't terribly interested. But now that the problems America tackled with from the beginning, like diversity, like religious liberty and so on, they're now urgent for the whole world, the world starts to look at America, and the United States is not doing so well. Take immigration, on our subject today, or take the subject that is religion and public life and so on, you can see that the last generation of the culture warring, the extremism and so on, you can see it in the present election. America is not a great example of how to do it. The issues we're talking about are fundamental to the American Republic. And of course, at a deeper level, they're fundamental to us as followers of Jesus. What's at stake for the Republic is the health of this country. And I would argue very bluntly that America in this generation has got to get this right once again, or America, quite frankly, will decline. Now, we're talking today, not just as citizens at large. I'm not even a citizen. I'm a great admirer of this country, but I'm not a citizen. We're talking today in this context as followers of Jesus. And for us, this issue is vital because our freedom to enter and engage public life is at stake. And if the culture warring goes on, and as I said bluntly, some of our brothers and sisters are part of the problem, not part of the answer, then our freedom to enter and engage public life will be at stake. And many of you know well, in business circles or public circles or whatever, our capacity to speak simply and straightforwardly today as Christians is clouded by all the controversies, and increasingly the public square, as they say, through the chill factor of these controversies, is freezing over. There are very deep stakes. And we have to sort out what we believe on this, what is best for us as followers of Christ, what is best for America as a great republic, and see these things restored, or this country and our Christian freedom and the freedom of many others is crucially at stake. Now, let's unpack it, and this time you've got the outline of what I'm saying, I believe, in your books. Let me go through at a relatively fast speed a number of issues that have to be grappled with to really work towards a viable solution today, and we've got to stand for whatever we believe is that constructive solution. Start, though, by seeing that this country is one of the three major settlements of religion and public life in the Western experience. If you look at the West, the three greatest settlements, in other words, arrangements for dealing with religion and public life, come from France, England, and the United States. And I said, I'm an admirer of this country, and I will argue your way is the best, but we need to understand them all in their historical context. Because what's happened is a very decisive year casts a long formative shadow down the centuries, so that today we're living in the light of what happened way back then. Now, what happened way back then for the French is quite clearly what? The Revolution. Now, you can capture the significance of the French Revolution in the cry of Diderot, the encyclopedist, which was picked up by the Jacobin radicals, the revolutionaries. And their cry was this: we want to strangle the last king with the guts of the last priest. A little gory and brutal, but you unpack that and you've got the whole French. The church and state were absolutely in bed with each other. They were in close collusion. They were both corrupt. And they were both oppressive. So the revolution threw off both. We want to strangle the last king with the guts of the last priest. Now that meant that in the French mentality then and today, say if you were going down to do a Veritas Forum, for instance, the Sorbonne, The French mentalité, mindset as they say, is that if you're in favor of freedom, you're secular. And if you're in favor of faith, you must be reactionary. And that is just written into the French mentality today. And with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the French system, you can see them now butting heads with the headscarves. The French were the ones behind getting any mention of the Christian faith in 1,500 years of European history, ruled out of the European Constitution. They are the symbol of a strict, strict secularism. Sarkozy is changing it a little, but for centuries that's been them. The middle position, as often, is England. Not Scotland, but England. The great year in England was 1680. Well, Scotland's different, but England in 1688 was the so-called Glorious Revolution. They kept a state church as a bulwark against the fear of the Catholic Church coming from the continent. They kept a state church, the Church of England, and even the Presbyterians would admit the Church of England was at least half reformed. It wasn't corrupt. It wasn't oppressive. There was certainly discrimination. If you were not Anglican, you had to go 5 miles out of town to worship. You couldn't go to Oxford and Cambridge. But there was no slaughter of the St. Bartholomew's Huguenots, for example, as happened in France. There wasn't any vicious persecution. But it was a state church. But a milder establishment. So there was no vicious, militant anti-clericalism. But it was a state church, and no one likes state churches in that way. So over 200 odd years, 300 now, it's faded away. And so the Church of England, some of you have been there, it's kind of like the rose window in a beautiful western front of British life. You know, as they say cynically, it's a national utility rather than an electricity company. And it's there for, as they put it, the hatching, matching, and dispatching of citizens. In other words, you baptize them, you marry them, and you bury them. And otherwise, you don't darken the door of the Church of England. And there are all sorts of statistics bandied around. There are more people who go to the mosque on Friday than the Church of England on Sunday, and so on. That's a little misleading, but those sort of things are bandied around. You've got a state church and a reaction against it, but a slow withering away because it was not that corrupt, and it certainly wasn't that oppressive. Now you move down the line, and you have this country. And the key year is what? Don't say 1776. It's actually 1791 when the First Amendment was passed in New York. And obviously, religion was disestablished. And as you know well, it flourished not despite disestablishment, but because of it. Because it became voluntary based on the dictates of conscience. Now, let me shift quickly, because I'm in support of that, not the other two, but you've got to understand the historical context. What was the difference that made to the whole American Republic? And you should know that the First Amendment, the first 16 words, the religious liberty clauses, they are the most decisively distinctive part of the Constitution. Americans think of separation of powers. That's not distinctive. Switzerland had that long before America. Montesquieu and others talked about that long before the framers did. The separation of powers, checks and balances, that isn't unique at all. What is absolutely unique are the religious liberty clauses. Never in all European history of the history of the church had anyone seen that. What difference did it make? Well, first, it underscored what the framers understood rightly as the first liberty. Religious liberty. Now, that's not fashionable today. If you ask most people what's the first liberty, what would they say? Most would say free speech, some freedom of assembly, some freedom of the press. Not for the framers. Logically and historically, religious liberty was the first liberty. Just think of it logically. Why do we value freedom of assembly? You want to have the right to get together with people you want to get together with. Well, if you think through why, obviously, freedom of assembly assumes freedom of speech. You want to get together with people to whom you want to say something that matters to you. But equally, freedom of speech assumes and requires freedom of conscience. At the end of the day, you don't want to get in public life and just sell something or talk about the weather. You want to get up in public and say something that means everything to you because you are bound to it by the dictates of your conscience. And logically, and this is clear in all the framers, they fought, as Washington said, for religious liberty and civil liberty. But religious liberty was the first. Also, you could say it's historically the first, because it's only when religious liberty was guaranteed that the other rights also were guaranteed. And some of the framers argued it was only so long as religious liberty was first that the others were also safe. Now, that isn't popular today. People tackle the extremists today through things like hate speech and hate crimes and so on. In other words, negative things, which are dangerous because they're relative. Hate speech is in the eyes of the beholder. Who's to say, looking into the human heart, what my hate is, your hate is, the eyes of the beholder, and therefore the hands of the sword wielder. But the framers didn't do that. They had a positive, inalienable right, freedom of conscience, religious liberty. Terribly important. That, for instance, will be the single strongest thing that changes Islamic extremism. If Islam comes to recognize the right of religious liberty, freedom of conscience. The second great legacy of the First Amendment was that in many ways it's the secret of American entrepreneurial vitality. And again, that sounds very odd today. Ask most Americans, where does this entrepreneurial spirit come from? They'd say, capitalism, business enterprise. No. It actually precedes it in the First Amendment. And if you think, the First Amendment in 1791 is decades before market capitalism swept this country. But the entrepreneurialism was there almost from the beginning, related to the First Amendment. Because the First Amendment does things parallel to market entrepreneurialism. What we call in business demonopolization, to a certain extent deregulation, is the equivalent of disestablishment. What we call a level playing field in business is the equivalent of religious liberty and equality for all. In other words, the First Amendment meant there was no preferences to any faith community. Whatever people believed based on dictates of conscience, and if they had the freedom and if they had the sacrifice and the generosity and the commitment, they could do it. And they did it. And you can see that the First Amendment gave rise to a huge upsurge of entrepreneurialism that we now call social entrepreneurialism. And it was behind not just the growth of the churches, but the growth of the educational movement. All the little booster colleges as the expansion west began, and each little church going westward planted its flag and its church and its college. It was behind the reform movement. Hundreds of reforms in the early 19th century, the supreme one being, of course, abolition. And it was behind one of the great explosions in history of all time of the charities. There's no question that in Europe and in this country in the early 19th century, never have more people been cared for at a single time than that moment. And the entrepreneurialism of the First Amendment was behind it. And most of it was evangelical. Because unlike the more hierarchical churches, the evangelicals fitted in well with that entrepreneurial spirit. They didn't need government support, etc., etc. So the First Amendment is really the key to that explosion of spiritual first and social entrepreneurialism second of the early 19th century. It's another topic, and I don't want to get into it particularly, but that's why I personally think that the president's faith-based initiatives are muddle-headed. Their motive is very worthy. To release and give a place for all the faith-based initiatives in our culture. That's a laudable motive. But he's gone about it in exactly the opposite way of the early 19th century. It was when the faith communities were on their own, with their own faith, and their own trust in the Lord and their own generosity and their own sacrifice that they did it all. Not when they put their noses in the trough of Uncle Sam. It was when they became independent. And you can see the rise of the voluntary association was led by evangelicals. It's one of our great creations in history. You had people like Leonard Bacon at Yale or others around him who were following William Wilberforce in Europe. And at first, Lyman Beecher, Leonard Bacon, they said the disestablishment of the Congregational Church in Connecticut would be disastrous. And they were bitter opponents of disestablishment. When it happened, to their surprise, within 3 years, the church flourished when it was disestablished. And they realized they'd been entirely wrong, and they were the founders of what Americans now call the Voluntary Association. The third great legacy of the First Amendment is social harmony. And here again, Americans know this so well, you almost yawn and you don't appreciate the significance of it. I put it like this. The First Amendment has allowed the United States to bring together two things that rarely come together. Strong religious convictions and strong political civility. And in this country, mostly, because there have been some egregious violations, they mostly complement each other rather than contradict each other. Now, there have been violations. You take, say, the Know-Nothing movement. You take, say, the vicious Protestant nativism, which was persecuting the Catholics, or sometimes deeply anti-Semitic. There have been violations, and we should be the first to admit them. They're nothing on the order of the European Crusades or the Inquisition or anything like that. But there have been violations in this country. But generally speaking, if you look at America's great problems, the problem of religious diversity, the problem of race, the problem of women, the framers got religious liberty right almost perfectly from the very beginning. And that's to their credit. They did not, as we know tragically, get race right. That's America's abiding curse. They did not get women right for a long time. And that was 1920s. Very, very slow in coming. But the framers did get religious liberty right. Now, to see that, you need to contrast this country with other countries around the world. They usually have one or the other. Strong political civility or strong political religious convictions, but not both. Take Western Europe. In the years after World War II, with the one exception of Northern Ireland, before the influx of the Commonwealth and North African immigration came, Western Europe was remarkably civil about religion. But I know, met several of you in the last day, have been to Western Europe a lot of times. You would say to yourself, big deal. There isn't any religion to be uncivil about. Contrast Scandinavia with the Scandinavians here. In the upper Midwest, Minnesota and so on, church going is still way above the American average. It's been as high as 7% from church going is 3%. If 3% go to church, you're not going to have bitter fights about it in the public arena. So a lot of the European civility is big deal. Now, you see the problem with that. They didn't have a solution to it. They had no First Amendment. They had no melting pot or any of these things. Then when the immigration came in, they didn't know how to handle it. You take, say, England or Holland, both very tolerant countries. And if you're tolerant, the obvious answer to a lot of new people is multiculturalism. Let them all do their own thing. What did they do? They bred enclaves of terrorism. And then when Theo van Gogh, the film director, was murdered, or you had the English terrorists bombing London, they suddenly realized this multicultural tolerance was crazy, but they had no way of dealing with it because they had no background like you've had here. And they're wrestling with it in ways that are rather pathetic. Some of you may have read the Dutch, in their amiable, liberal, tolerant fashion, wanted to bring in the immigrants in a friendly way, so they produced a videotape for all the new Muslim immigrants. And it included pictures of Dutch life and tulips. It also included pictures of topless bathing on the Dutch beaches. You can imagine how well that went over with the Muslims. You can see Europe didn't know how to wrestle with it. Now, the Middle East, of course, is the opposite problem. Passionate religious convictions, even within the same religion. No civility, no liberty, no life. And America's done a remarkable job, although, as I said, it's breaking down. Let's move on to that. What are the factors since the First Amendment that have changed things so that the American settlement is not doing as well as it used to? They're relatively obvious, and it's the third one that bedevils the other ones. The first, an obvious one, is an exploding pluralism. In 1791 or earlier, the most diverse place on the earth were the middle colonies. There were scores and scores and scores of sects, say, in Pennsylvania. But they were all Protestant. Dutch, Swiss, German, Scottish, you name it. Scores of them. They were Christian. And then came sizable numbers of Jews. And then sizable numbers of Catholics. And then in the early 19th century, you had the Made in America religions, like the Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, and so on. And you can say that right down until the 1950s, America was incredibly diverse. But it was a very loose biblical diversity, not with a capital B, not that we say the Mormons are Christians. Not from the Bhagavad Gita, not from the Pali Canon, but from the scriptures. They weren't Christian, but it was a loosely biblical faith, and the pluralism, in that sense, didn't explode in any way that militated against each other. But in the 1960s, there were two huge changes. First was an incredible growth of secularism. In the early 60s, secularism was about 2% of Americans, and went up to 8, 9, 10, 11, polls differ, but a huge, it's the biggest increase, religiously speaking, in the 20th century. And, of course, the most significant, because that's the educated classes. On the other hand, you had an explosion of all the world's religions. Think of all the Buddhists who came in after the Vietnam War, and so on. The growth of Muslims converted in jail through the Black Power movement, and so on, and so on, and so on. So now, you can say you've got an example of every religion in today's world somewhere in America, most probably in California, where my wife comes from. Now, how do you handle that? What does, say, school prayer mean in Southern California when you've got 90 religions in one school district? Christians get very upset about this sometimes. But I met a Georgia parent who was a Baptist, who'd moved to Utah. And we were discussing this. He said, I couldn't for the life of me when I lived in Georgia, this is 20 years ago, couldn't for the life of me see what the Jewish parents were worried about when they objected to Christian prayer in our Georgia public schools. He said, until I went to Utah, and my little son was now the Jew in the class of a room full of Baptists, except they were Mormons. Now, as you start figuring out what the golden rule means, as Madison put it, what diversity means, freedom of conscience for all, in a very diverse situation with, say, 90 religions in one school district. There are Christians like Michael Novak who argues, and obviously the principle is one in, or one out, all out. If religious liberty is equality for all, freedom of conscience for all, the minority as well as the majority, Michael Novak is a good friend of mine, and it's a perfectly legitimate argument, would say one in, all in. In other words, you'd have a Christian prayer and a Jewish prayer and a Muslim prayer and a Hindu prayer and a Wiccan prayer. You go on down the line every day of the school month. I think that would lead to absolute apathetic indifference to all the faiths. You know the statement of Ronnie Knox, comparative religion makes people comparatively religious. And that's the effect of that sort of sloppy, we're all-inclusive type of approach. I think in public schools, one out, all out, the public school isn't the place for teacher-led worship. Of course, the Equal Access Bill ensures the right of Christians or Jews, whoever wants to pray when it's not teacher-led. and Young Life classes and all that, absolutely legitimate. And the ACLU is the other extreme, getting even that out if they can. That's wrong. But teacher-led prayer, I think no. In a day of exploding diversity. Now, we've got to think that through. I'm sure a lot of you disagree with me. The second huge change is an expanding statism. This country has never had a church and state. It was always churches and states, even when there were established churches, Virginia for a while, Connecticut, and so on and so on and so on. But the important point was in 1791, churches were close physically, and they were strong spiritually and socially in the lives of their members. And the state, whatever it was a long way away. 200 years later, for many people, their faith community is still relatively close, although, say, in somewhere like L.A., they may drive 50 miles to church, and it's not at all close. But more importantly, the state is huge. Just take April the 15th. Many people's lives, the state is far stronger and more important in their life than their faith communities. Many faith communities, sadly, are on the level of a golf club membership or whatever. And you can see some of the worst decisions from the Supreme Court have been made in the name of the state. Now, you could argue, but many religious liberty activists would say, and the details don't matter, the worst decision recently on religious liberty was the Smith case. We need to go into the details. What's interesting, the Smith case, which produced a furious reaction among religious liberty activists, was argued in the name of the state. But it was argued not by one of the liberals on the Supreme Court, but by the most conservative and the most devout, but in the name of the state. And you can be sure the state with zoning and various other things is going to be a real menace to our religious liberty in the future, unless we get this right. But it's the third factor which has changed everything. An emerging separationism. Separationism. Republican congresswoman, described the separation of church and state as a lie and a myth. And you've probably all heard members of the Christian right who say the separation of church and state is not in the Constitution. Now, she was dead wrong. And they are dead wrong. The phrase is not in the Constitution. The principle emphatically is. And not a single framer would have misunderstood that. Not only that, not a single evangelical, hardly a single American would have misunderstood that in the early days. The separation of church and state is part of the genius of the way the Constitution orders this country. Read Tocqueville, Alexis Tocqueville. He comes here in 1831. He says he didn't find a single person in America who disagreed with the separation of church and state, including his fellow Catholics, who in Europe would have been solid supporters of the state establishment in France, say. Here, they thought the separation of church and state was the secret of American liberty, and they were all, including the Catholics, for it. Why are we not today? The answer is that in the 1940s, a new idea came in. It's called strict separation, or separationism. The idea that religion is inviolably private and the public square is inviolably secular, neutral. That is new. They quote Jefferson, but Jefferson did not practice that one bit. And if you know the story of Thomas Jefferson, our great Virginian, Jefferson, on the Friday when he was president, wrote the famous letter to the Danbury Baptists about the wall of separation, which they quote. That was Friday. On Sunday, Jefferson went to church, not because he believed, but because as chief magistrate, as he said, he needed to be seen going to church because religion was important to the Republic. He went to the biggest church service in America. And do you know where it was? Under the roof of the Capitol. And every Sunday he was in Washington, Jefferson was there. He gave money to evangelical causes, even to evangelistic causes. He brought Episcopalians, he brought Baptists into the administrative branch, in the executive branch in the White House, the Treasury Department, the White House, and so on. He even invited them to have communion services in the White House. Jefferson believed in the wall of separation, but his wall is not the modern separationist wall. It's actually much closer. If ever you've been to Monticello or University of Virginia, his academical village, it's much more like his serpentine wall that's wavy. It was rather more pragmatic and utilitarian than strict. But the new view, and sadly, the new view was brought in not only by secularists and by Jews who wanted a strict separation, it was argued in the Supreme Court by Baptists. And sadly, the man who made some of the strongest decisions on it as a Baptist was also a member of the Ku Klux Klan, and who saw strict separation as a means of keeping Catholics out of public life. Now, of course, it's rebounding on all Christians out of public life. But sadly, there were Baptist voices at the beginning who were part of the problem of this contribution to the strict view of the separation of church and state, so that religion is inviolably private, and the public square Baptist voices were there at the beginning, very, very foolishly and unwisely, and sadly for rather evil reasons. And that bedeviling factor now comes down to us. And of course, it's part of our culture wars. So let's move on to where we are right now, because what you have is the culture warring of which religion and public life is the holy war front. There are many other issues. But religion and public life, beginning with Madeleine Murray O'Hare, the school prayer cases in 1962, right down to the controversies today over the Ten Commandments, over Christmas carols, over the cross and the Los Angeles crest, and so on. There is no end to what now cannot be sued about. We're in a highly contentious, litigious moment where religion and public life is the source of endless controversy. Now, as many of us see it, there are actually two extremes. You might disagree with me on this, too. Two extremes. Well, I'll describe it as people like Richard Neuhaus and I and a number of others see it. At one extreme, you have what's called in the culture warring the sacred public square. Those who know that no faith can be established, but one faith should always be preferred. Now, obviously, supporters of school prayer would be in that camp. The Reconstructionists are a very extreme version of that camp. But importantly, almost all the religious right are seen by their opponents as in that camp, a sacred public square which would privilege the place of the Christian faith. Of course, behind it you have Muslims who'd like to replace the Constitution with a caliphate and have Muslim influence in the sacred public square. Now, we haven't time for a full argument. Put very simply, any notion of a sacred public square where someone's faith is privileged over all others in a society as diverse as this is unjust and unworkable. And it will always create endless controversy. Now, I would just point out this, even if you disagree with that. Europe, as many of you have mentioned and we've actually talked about in the course of the last 24 hours, Europe is deeply secular. The principal reason, not the only one, but the principal reason for European secularity today is corrupt state churches yesterday, sadly. America never had that problem because of the First Amendment. Congenial, hospitable to all faiths, and the high noon was the Eisenhower era when Eisenhower welcomed religions of all sort, whatever people believed, and so on. We're a long way from that today. In the last 30 years, the combination of the culture warring and the rise of the religious right means you can trace a steadily mounting American reaction to religion, which in the educated classes is the American equivalent of the European repudiation of religion. Earlier on, the reaction was to religion in public life. And you have books like Kevin Phillips's American Theocracy or Christopher Hedges's American Fascism. Ludicrous, you say, but they're reacting to the religious right and what they see behind it, the Muslim extremists. And I would say, sadly, that many of our brothers and sisters, through their unwisdom, have produced the very thing they fear. And when you read the new atheists, they are irrational, they're intolerant, But largely in this country, what they're reacting against is our brothers and sisters that they see as religious extremists. We have produced that fear decisively. Now, the other side's no better. It's what Richard Neuhaus famously called the naked public square. And you can see they're made up of two main groups, secularists, in other words, those who have the philosophy, there is no God, there is no supernatural, but they're also made up of the strict separationists. They may not necessarily be atheists themselves, but they believe that religion has to be inviolably private and the public square has to be inviolably secular. The combination is what's called legal secularism, but the effect is keep religion out of public life. Now, that's even more unjust and even more unworkable for a simple reason. Most Americans are still religious, overwhelmingly Christian, but many other religions do. And to exclude everyone from public life is highly illiberal. You could argue that not only that, it actually undermines the way the framers created this republic and its notion of sustainable freedom, but that's another argument. But there's no question that the naked public square is deeply illiberal, although it's promoted by liberals, because they're asking religious believers to shed the very things that makes them who they are and allows them to see the world they do. The constitutional showers, as it were asked to go through, are rather like a constitutional equivalent of what leads to the gas chambers. We're not allowed to be the human beings we know ourselves to be in public life in this view. Now, it's beginning to crack. It used to be supported in this country by people like John Rawls, who's very influential in the political world, and in Europe by Jürgen Habermas. But if any of you have followed these things, Jürgen Habermas, the European atheist, now is beginning to argue against Rawls and against the American liberals that religious voices should be in the public square. And Habermas now agrees with Pope Benedict against the American secularist views. So some of the strongest defenders, theoretically, politically, and so on, of this strict separation are in America, not now in Europe, which is one of the signs of hope in Europe. The alternative, I would argue, you have to think this through for yourself. The two extremes I've described are strong, they are very well funded, and they are very well defended. Batteries of lawyers. 20 years ago, one of the leaders of the ACLU said to me, there's a simple reason we will always win in the long run. We have more lawyers than anyone else. But they don't today. And now you have batteries of lawyers answered by batteries of lawyers and just endless litigation. And there's no end in sight to what can't be litigated and created into a controversy. Many of these things are ludicrous. The alternative, and some of us are beginning to argue for this, but at the moment, there's no national leadership, there's no strong funding, and there are no batteries of lawyers, because this is something outside the law. It's closer to what Tocqueville called the habits of the heart. It's the vision of a civil public square. What do I mean? The word civility is a weak word today. It's probably a wimp word today. People think it's to do with dinner party manners and how you hold your fork and that sort of nonsense. No. Civility, properly understood, is a republican virtue, with a small r, and a democratic necessity in a diverse age, with a small d. What do I mean by civil public square? A civil public square is a vision of public life in which everyone of all faiths are free to enter and engage public life on the basis of their faith, but, here's the big but, within an agreed, taught, passed-on framework of what is understood to be right and just for people of other faiths too. So religious liberty, freedom of conscience, means that a right for a Christian is immediately and automatically a right for a Jew and a right for an atheist and a right for a Hindu and a right for a Buddhist and so on. And one of the tests of religious liberty is, does it apply to the tiniest minority and the most unpopular community? Most unpopular in some circles today would be, say, Scientology. Well, Scientology, which I think is outrageous in what it believes, they have the right to believe it. So civility is a framework in which people are free to enter and engage public life, but with a commitment to what is just and free for others too. So a right for one is a right for another and a responsibility for both. And our Christian rights are best guaranteed as we guarantee and safeguard the rights of others, even those with whom we disagree strongly. Now, of course, there are all sorts of implications of that, which, among other things, you have to persuade people rather than coerce them. I remember one of the founders of MTV said to me, talking about the pro-life movement, if the pro-life movement were persuasive, they would win the argument easily. He said if they were as persuasive as the Damas television ads, they would have won it long ago. But they don't try and persuade. They protest and pronounce and proclaim, baby killer, etc., etc. And they just alienate people. They're not persuasive like William Wilberforce. But persuasion is a necessary corollary of a civil society. If you disagree with people about marriage or life or whatever it is, you have to persuade them, as Wilberforce did, over abortion. If we don't persuade, we can't expect to win the argument. Now, of course, persuasion, you needn't go too far in this, it assumes the old word, apologetics, the capacity to make a persuasive case for what we want to argue for, not just for the resurrection, but for marriage. It's no use saying the Bible says to people who don't read the Bible or believe in God. How do we make sociological arguments, historical arguments, anthropological arguments, as Wilberforce did for all these things, in the public square? In other words, RZIM is needed by all American Christians today. And without good apologetics, we're stuck, because almost everything in public life assumes persuasion. And if we don't have the capacity to persuade, we're voiceless. And many Christians are voiceless, or at least they're highly vocal, but they're saying it in ways that don't make any sense to many people. A civil public square. Now, let me add quickly, and I'll draw it to conclusion, throw it open to you. There are a lot of misunderstandings around civility, and I'm sure many of you have objections in your mind. If you're thinking along, you're bound to. One objection, which I won't deal with in depth, is that a civil public square is dangerous because it's the same as civil religion. It's not. Civil religion is a very dangerous idea, which came from Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And was the idea that if you didn't have an establishment, in other words, an established church which gave you unity and legitimacy, something had to give you unity and legitimacy. So what happened was you tended to take whatever binds you together as a nation, and then you revere it, you respect it, you worship it. And eventually your point of unity becomes a civil religion. Now that's very dangerous for Jews and Christians. Why? There is one God, and there is no God but God. And even the greatest, most wonderful of nations is an idol if it's ever put in the Lord's place. A civil public square, we're talking about secular things, like political rights, like freedom of conscience, and so on. We're not talking about anything religious. I would say, as an Englishman, civil religion does creep in this country. You know, when Sunday overlaps with July the 4th, there are hymns that our church sings, wonderful church, evangelical church, I've refused to sing, about freedom's holy light and stuff like that. You know the hymn that comes from. That's not right. Freedom is a wonderful gift, but it is not sacred. It is not holy. The Lord alone is holy. All these things are wonderful secular gifts he's given us to enjoy on this earth. A civil public square is a secular settlement of these things. It's not civil religion. We don't worship even the best of our economic systems, our nations, or whatever. So don't confuse those. The second and far deeper confusion is people thinking a civil public square is a search for the lowest common denominator unity. And particularly the people who think the answer to religious diversity, and a lot of Christians do this, is a wonderful interfaith dialogue. And if we really love all these good people around us with different faiths, and we talk to them long enough, at some happy moment we'll get down to the place we all agree. Nonsense. That's utopian nonsense. The deeper you go, the more you see the differences are deep and irreducible. Take an obvious one. We worship Jesus as Lord and God. And our brothers and sisters in the early church would rather die than give the incense to Caesar as Lord and God. He is Lord and God, not just a prophet. A devout Muslim cannot remain a devout Muslim and say with us that he's Lord and God. And we equally cannot say that Jesus is just a prophet, as they would say. There are differences at the end of the day, and that's within the Abrahamic faith. Move outside to the Hindus, the Buddhists, and the atheists. Differences are deep and irreducible. Civility is a framework within which we are free to be different, which means free to be faithful to our faith, and yet know how to negotiate those differences robustly but civilly. Now, generally speaking, the public square is not the place to have our apologetic arguments. I love apologetics, and I go to the Veritas forums and so on. But that's not the Washington discussion. Washington's talking about not the roots of our beliefs, but the results and how that touches things like the policy on abortion or the policy on marriage or the policy on debt or whatever it is. So we're discussing there the results of these things, but the public square, generally speaking, is not the place to be discussing the roots of these things, or you get into very, very bitter and deep controversies almost instantly. And we need to know the difference of when to speak and when not to speak, and so on. My own illustration is that civility is like the Queensbury rules in boxing. If you know the history of boxing, the Romans banned it. Surprising when you think of the Colosseum. Over 1 million humans slaughtered in the Colosseum. They loved that, but they thought boxing was too gory. Now, boxing was pretty brutal. The 19th century people sometimes, Colorado bare-knuckle fights, London prize fights, they fought for 100 rounds, and one or the other died at the end of it. Pretty brutal stuff. And along came the Marquess of Queensbury, one of England's sporting aristocrats, and he lent his name to the Queensbury rules of boxing. And you know them roughly. He put boxing in a ring, within rules. He didn't punch below the belt, for example. And, importantly, under a referee. In a ring, within rules, under a referee. But while they touch gloves at the beginning, and they don't punch below the belt, unless they want to be disqualified, they still... entered the ring. And the first year, he put out the abolition bill, defeated. Defeated, 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 defeated. How many rounds did he go? 20 before he won the first time. 47 years before he won finally. But he went back in and back in and back in. That's democracy. Civility is not going to be handed to us because we're a majority. If we believe things are true, arguments, we've got to win hearts and minds. We're not there to blast people, not Ann Coulter, Al Franken style, just demonizing our enemies. We've got to win hearts and minds if we want to really achieve what we want to achieve, and so on. That's democracy. It's not a lowest common denominator unity. There are real issues to be, quote, fought out, but fought out is now in quotes. And one of the heart of what we've got to do is speak the truth with love if we follow Jesus. We've got to, Jesus told us to, love our enemies. When the Christian right demonizes its enemies, say in direct mail, they're being sub-Christian. Jesus told us to love our enemies. When one of Wilberforce's enemies, and he had enemies who literally mugged him twice, physically ganged up on him and attacked him, let alone vilified him all the time. When one of his worst enemies died, he immediately saw the man's widow, was given a pension. He was always gracious to his worst enemies. He loved his enemies because he was a follower of Jesus. So he did the Lord's work in the Lord's way, not just whatever it takes in the modern culture warring sense. The other misconception, I'm sure some of you have come across this with your friends, is that civility means a false tolerance. We eventually don't care about differences or truth. No. Interestingly, that argument today comes not only from fundamentalists who fear that, but also from the new atheists. You notice how Richard Dawkins and the others, they don't just refuse to tolerate extremists, they don't tolerate moderates who tolerate extremists. as they put it. And there is no one today more intolerant on the American scene than the new atheists, because they're afraid that tolerance means respect towards whatever. But if you think of it, this is the way I put it. The right to believe anything does not mean that anything anyone believes is right. Figure that one out. The right to believe anything, that's freedom of conscience. Now, you just think, in our theology, the Lord allows us to choose an eternity without him. He doesn't, as Roger Williams says, rape our conscience. If the Lord allows us freedom of conscience to choose against him, there are actually deep theological grounds for freedom of conscience. It's not just a political right. There are theological reasons. The right to believe anything, that's freedom of conscience. But the right to believe anything doesn't mean that anything anyone believes is right. That's just plain nonsense. People have the freedom of conscience to believe things which are muddle-headed, which are untrue, which may be evil. But it means we have to debate respecting their right to believe what they believe, but we disagree with them. So we use all the means of persuasion and love and imagination to win them to something better. And so on. The right to believe anything does not mean that anything anyone believes is right. So we're not talking about a sloppy tolerance that covers everything. Of course, we know that tolerance is not the best word for religious liberty. That's why Madison changed it. Tolerance is condescending. It's always the strong tolerating the weak. The majority tolerating the minority. The government tolerating the citizens. That's not a right. That's condescension. Locke used the word tolerance. Madison, in 1776, changed the word in the Virginia Declaration. He was only 23, but he had the guts to argue against George Mason and all the others there. He struck the word tolerance and put in the words free exercise. And that's the glory of American understanding of religious liberty, a very positive right. And so we're not talking about some sloppy tolerance that's indifferent to truth or indifferent to consequences. People have the right, and therefore we give them the respect, to believe whatever they truly believe. I think Wicca can be dangerous. I think Scientology is ludicrous. I think a Hindu view of the retreat from life is disastrous. You go on down the line. But they have the right to believe that before God and before the state. But it means that I respect their right and then have to use every form of persuasion from love to argument and the demonstration in our own lives to win them to a better way. Now, I'll finish with this thought. Religion gets it right. Your generation, many of you are under 35, you look at the culture warring. You've grown up with a culture warring that's as natural to you as people have grown up with the internet. It's just there all around you. Historically, though, the culture warring is disastrous for this republic. Your generation has to get this right. It will require leadership. It will require courage. I believe you probably need a leader who's got the courage of a Lincoln and the stature of a Roosevelt. Eventually, to break with the culture warring and say, in effect, a pox on both your houses. Here is a better way for Americans of all backgrounds. It will take incredible courage, but all of us have to be part of this. You either have to get this right in the next 50 years, or America will decline. But of course, as followers of Jesus this morning, we understand, get this. The great Alexis de Tocqueville, the greatest European commentator from the outside, as Stuart and I are, in our little way. Tocqueville, you know, is a lover of this country and American democracy. You've probably read his book. He loved the American Revolution. He was a disappointed lover in the French Revolution. It just didn't work out, and all the governments after that were equally disastrous, including Napoleon. At the end of his life, Tocqueville, musing over all the things he'd seen since he was a 24-year-old traveling around the U.S. and writing his first bestseller, Tocqueville made this very interesting little remark. With a revolution, as with a novel, The hardest part to invent is the ending. With a revolution, as with a novel, the hardest part to invent is the ending. You Americans had a brilliant first chapter. Never in history have there been so many great, far-sighted, courageous statesmen all at one time. We've had our Pericles, we've had our Winston Churchills, but they were giants in their generation above their generation. You had this incredible generation all at one time. They weren't perfect. They had terrible flaws, as we know, with things like race. But the opening chapter of the American Revolution was an incredible chapter. 230-odd years later, you're in trouble. Or at the very least, you're not the city to the world, on the hill to the world, that many Americans think they are or once used to be. You're in trouble. And it will take leadership and courage and vision to address this problem. And I would say to you passionately, as a European admirer of this country, and more importantly, as a Christian brother involved in this country, become part of the problem, the solution, not as much of the Christian right are, part of the problem.
Thank you, Oz.
With respect to your comment about public education and one out, all out, realizing that a vacuum of ideas does not exist, how would you help us counteract, or what would your suggestion be to counteract the fact that secularism and even atheism is replacing and filling the vacuum in our public schools?
Yeah. No, a great question, and it's too big to answer very deeply, but just a few thoughts. First, public education. It's in a massive crisis today on lots of levels, so many, many Christians I meet dismiss the whole thing, and you have the flight to the Christian schools. But I think those who dismiss it forget what American public education was designed to do. When Jefferson and Thomas Mann and some of the others in the early 19th century designed it, the idea was not just free universal education. It was free universal education, public, common, that transcended all the diversity of class and creed. So American values should have been taught. Now, the crisis today is not only a crisis educationally, it's a crisis civically. The public schools have long given up teaching the American unum, as it's called. In other words, your great motto, a pluribus unum, out of many, one, is not only a motto, it's an incredible achievement. But if it's not kept alive, America will balkanize. So you can see this in the immigration debate. I'm not arguing immigration broadly, but one of the missing themes in the immigration debate, people talk about the need for the immigration for business and the need for control of the borders and English as a second, and so on. What's missing is the idea of citizenship education. You can take in this country almost limitless number of people with the space you have here compared with European countries, so long as everyone who's come in is taught what it means to be American. But in the last few years since 1965, you have an open-door policy virtually with the illegal aliens, and there's no citizenship education. America's deep in trouble. So first we have to see the purpose of public education at all. Now then, your very important point. Religion comes into public education, and therefore into the controversies, usually in three ways. The teaching of history, worship, which is the one I addressed, and ethics, values. There is no question, and this one is mostly agreed, that the secularist rewriting of American history that drowned out all references to religion was just plain bad history. And that argument has mostly been won, except among some of the diehards. In other words, it's ludicrous to have history cutting out religion, and particularly American history. You simply can't make sense of it if you cut out the role of faith. Historically, the textbook should be absolutely blunt and clear about the right role of faith in history. It's there. Then the other area I didn't mention is values or ethics. Clearly, ethics have to have, well, you have to have ethics, otherwise the vacuum you mentioned. Now, there have been states like Maryland who have done it this way. They got together all the religious, including the secularist representation in Maryland, and they said, we've got to teach ethics in Maryland public schools. Which ones do you want? And they agreed, they all agreed, say, on honesty, loyalty, patriotism, and a whole number of things. I think about 12. All of them, Christian, Jewish, atheist, Muslim, you name it, they all agreed on those. What they agreed to do was to teach the ethics, but tell the students and the families particularly the roots of the ethics, that was the Christian root of honesty, is different from an atheist root or a Hindu root. Now, they all have some commitment to honesty, but I would say the Jewish and Christian one is the toughest and deepest. The roots of it, why we are honest, because our God is a God of truth. Now, that's not the place for the public schools to teach the roots in terms of why we as Christians believe in honesty, because God and his commitment to truth. We'll leave the others to teach they want, but we'll teach honesty in the public schools. So you cannot afford a vacuum that creates an ethical desert. Your point is a good one. So I personally am against teacher-led, official, school-sanctioned worship. But I'm in favor of very good teaching of history, including all religion, and very good teaching of values, except not teaching them the full why. Do you understand? Now, that's a shorthand discussion of a far, far bigger one.
What is the best way to expose ourselves to a civil debate on issues? I'm finding fair and balanced just doesn't do it for me anymore.
Well, you know, fair and balanced is not very civil. And if you ever watched Bill O'Reilly pull the plug literally on people so they're left, you know, that is not civil debate. No, we've got to begin with our own discussions, you know, in our neighborhoods and in our businesses and so on. And we were sharing at breakfast how exceedingly difficult this is, because as the culture wars spread further and further, the very mention of faith now, and a little nuclear reaction goes off in certain people. So we need to think as Christians. We begin with love. Are we, and I'm preaching to myself, are we first and foremost known for our love of people? And then take some other, if we speak the truth with love, or as it says elsewhere in the New Testament, with grace, how do we engage? For instance, I often meet on campuses students who come up from good Georgia backgrounds or whatever backgrounds. They want to be faithful to Christ. Professor who's laying evolution in the line, attacking idiots who believe the Bible and so on. They want to state right out, I'm a Bible-believing, this, that, and the other, and put all their cards. It's wonderfully faithful, but absolutely stupid. Because they lack the ability to persuade. So, for instance, if you have someone whose mind is closed, they can be very indifferent, very hostile, whatever it is, their mind is closed, and you can see it in their reactions. The first of the biblical answers is don't say anything, love and listen. The second is ask them questions, don't make statements. Why are the first responses to disobedience and unbelief in the scriptures constantly questions, not statements? We're not good question answers. We want to lay all our cards out on the table as if that's a matter of faithfulness. It's ineffective very often. So here's a case we've got to learn, of course, always rooted, as I said, in love, to really be wise in our ability to persuade and so on. Then people will slowly relax. We're not one of those people that they feared and so on. Because there's an immense amount of prejudice on that side. No easy answers there. But we've got an awful lot to live down.
Oz, thank you first for thinking through this so carefully and sharing it with us. Is it fair to say, based on what you've taught us today, that the only people that are not welcome in the public square are those who do not share the agreed values that we should be passing down about a civil public square And do we, should we as Christians be helping police the civility of the public square, even advocating for those we don't agree with their place to be there as part of that passing down of these values?
Mm-hmm. I think part of the, if we're truly showing that we're committed to civility for everyone and the rights of other people not like us, we've got to demonstrate that at times. It was to the credit of the Jews and to the ACLU. I'm not a great fan of the ACLU. Nazis to march in Skokie, Illinois. They disagreed with them passionately, but they guaranteed their rights to speak out and to have freedom of assembly. That was to their credit. I don't often say things complimenting the ACLU on these issues. Now, equally, we've got to be seen to be guardians of the rights of others if we want our own to be heard. And that's just part, I think, of the golden rule. You deal with others the way you'd like others to deal with you. And we've got to be seen to be doing that for others. And Christians at the moment. One Jewish journalist said to me in the 1980s, evangelicals talk of justice, but they sound like just us. And we've got to be known for that. Let me just say that on Wednesday, a number of us are publishing at the National Press Club an evangelical manifesto. I say this today because the World Magazine evidently broke the story, which was under embargo, which they shouldn't have done. Typical, a Christian magazine broke it. The secular press didn't. And when they broke it yesterday, AP went nationwide on it. And this evangelical manifesto is in the confusion today. It came out of a time 3 years ago when in 1 week, I met more than a dozen people dropping out of being evangelical. Two of them were eminent scholars. It was just too embarrassing and too shameful because evangelicalism was associated with cultural things like fundamentalism or political things, always political extremism, and they were dropping out. It didn't mean anything to them. But when I heard what it was they were defining it as, and I thought, my goodness, if that's what evangelicalism, I wouldn't be an evangelical. And so this manifesto says who evangelicals are. Put simply, we are those who define ourselves, our faith, and our lives by the good news, the gospel of Jesus. We are not defined first by culture. We are not defined first by politics. We are followers of Jesus. Now, the trouble is, even to say that, you can see this in the press responses, will itself be politicized? Because in the culture warring climate, everything is politicized, and so on. But if you read of this, it's an attempt to call evangelicals back to be evangelicals. We are first and foremost followers of Jesus. So some of us were Republicans, some Democrats, some this, some that. They're always secondary for us. As Richard Neuhaus says, well, the first thing to say about politics is that politics is not the first thing. The main thing, I occur again, is Jesus and his kingdom. Stewart said King Jesus. Not the Republican Party, not the Democratic Party, not the Tory Party, not the Socialist Party. We hang loose on all of these things. Yes, as the manifesto puts it, we are fully engaged, but never completely equated. We are Christ people first and last, not Republicans, Democrats, Americans, English, French, Kenyans, or whatever. And you'll see this, the manifesto, it's trying to say that and call us back to a reform of ourselves, and that itself will be politicized. That's the crazy world in which we are.
The proceeding was a presentation of the C.S. Lewis Institute. In the legacy of C.S. Lewis, the Institute endeavors to develop disciples who can articulate, defend, and live faith in Christ through personal and public life. For more information, please visit our website at www.cslewisinstitute.org. Thank you.